Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Amwha Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Amwha Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another exciting episode of NucleCast. Of course, as always, I'm your host, Adam Wilder. Today, we have, as we do always, a great guest. Now, we have Rebecca Heinrichs, and for many of you, you probably know her. She's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and the director of the Keystone Defense Initiative. And of course, she was on the Strategic Posture Commission. Rebecca, welcome to NucleCast.
Thank you so much for having me, Adam.
So as we were talking before the show, we were thinking about the best topics to cover. And you mentioned that in the about 90 days since the report, the Strategic Posture Commission's report was released, there have been a number of interesting things that have sort of come about from that. And sort of, we talked with Frank Mueller about the report sort of early on after it was released. And one of the things that struck us was how little the media was covering it, because it was, as a bipartisan commission, you had, Democrats on the commission that you would not normally expect to be supportive of the kinds of policies that you were advocating. And so now, as we're a few months on, what are some of these interesting things that have come about based on the report?
Thanks. Well, I agree with the assessment that the media didn't cover it as much as we would have liked. But of course, it's because of, I think that the main thing I would attribute that to is how bad things are going abroad. So there's crises after crises. Obviously, the attacks against Israel, October 7th. And so that was a big one. And then our own forces are under attack by Iranian proxies throughout the Middle East. And so that has garnered a lot of media attention, understandably. But I think another reason, as I've had meetings with members of Congress and their staff and allies, another theme has sort of bubbled to the surface. And that is that there's broad agreement on the threat assessment of the Strategic Posture Commission's report, the findings. And so nothing really surprised people. And I think that really goes to show just how much things have changed since 2009, the last time there was a Strategic Posture Commission report. And so there is a sense that the threat environment has deteriorated so much that the two nuclear peer environment is incredibly challenging, and that the United States is ill prepared to handle that. It's been bipartisan. There's been some objections, mainly on the issue of how are we going to afford this? What are our priorities going to be? It would have, one of the recurring themes is we wish that you would have been more specific or ranked priorities. And we've answered that. Some of the commissioners have answered those criticisms, I think, pretty well. But then also, I've gotten a lot of eagerness on the part of allies to say, put us in. How can we contribute to the deterrence mission? What can we do? We just need some leadership and direction from the United States.
Now, you mentioned allies, and I think back to when I used to represent the Air Force at meetings overseas, particularly in Europe, and our allies in New Europe would oftentimes say, hey, Adam, how do I get the F-35? We'd like to see nuclear weapons in, Poland, for example. Are you seeing sort of old Europe and new Europe both equally interested, or are you seeing new Europe more interested? Because I know those further to the east feel the Russia threat, most acutely. So how has been this response, and what might allies say? This is, we want weapons stationed in our country. We want systems. What do they want?
Well, the specifics I think are still being worked out, but a lot of them, and you know, it's an interesting phenomenon. You know, what is said officially, sort of publicly, and then in sort of closed door meetings where allies are trying out ideas or trying to get responses from Americans who work on these issues. So they're varied. Definitely, obviously, there's interest in Eastern Central Europe for increased U.S. demonstration of commitment. You know, always interested to see the United States bolster credibility of what the United States would be willing to do to lead the alliance to protect the smallest nations within the NATO alliance. And so I think that continues to be the case, and even more so since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2020. So, 2022. Was that 2022?
Right.
Time is a flat circle with Russian aggression. And then I think another interesting phenomenon has been a lot of interest on the part of our Asian allies. You know, that this is not the Japan of 10 years ago, 15 years ago. And so there's an interest in the Japanese government, I think, or Japanese citizens in the think tank world to hear more about what the United States is thinking about extended deterrence. The Australians, very eager to make AUKUS happen, and Pillar 2 in particular, which we give some oxygen to in the strategic posture report. But I'm very interested in, you know, what can we do with B-21 when B-21 comes online with our allies in Asia. And so there's some interesting, I think, opportunities there. You know, it's different things. It's more information. How is the, you know, the South Koreans always want more commitment, more demonstration of commitment from the United States. And they want to be in on what the United States is doing and how we're thinking about extended deterrence. But it doesn't have to be basing, you know, exactly. It can just be a greater part of maybe refueling or periodic stationing and et cetera. So, but still the demand is high. And I haven't received any really strong pushback from some of the findings of the commission. You know, you've got some folks in the think tank world kind of raised alarms about a potential quote unquote arms race. I don't really think that criticism is credible, since the United States is really coming from behind in the two-peer nuclear threat. That it doesn't look to me like anything like an arms race that we saw during the Cold War, and so that criticism hasn't really bubbled up in terms of from our allies that I've heard, at least, more of an American think tank criticism. So I think lots of opportunities, but you know what the commission what the posture commission did, I think. And Bob Peters from the Heritage Foundation, I think, wrote this or first said this, and I thought that it was so true. Really kind of set the new, this now is the consensus view. And so sort of, you know, it's the consensus bipartisan view. And now that we've sort of moved the ball further down the field, to stick with the football analogy here, we got to go from there now. And that's on a variety of policies. I'm looking at the nuclear posture, but then also looking at missile defense policy, et cetera. And so we've really come a long way, I think, over the last 15 years. And this really is the new sort of baseline for where the country has to go.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I wonder, within the, you know, sort of the arms control community, they oftentimes throw out things like, well, it'll cause an arms race. And my question is, what evidence do you have that an arms race is bad? I mean, do arms races stop wars? Because I happen to think they actually do. And so I sort of hear things like, oh, strategic stability, we'll define that. What does it look like? Give me the variables and characteristics of it. And then show me your data that says this is destabilizing or stabilizing. I hear lots of pejoratives, but I don't hear good definitions and data that support the pejoratives. Can you maybe talk about some of these assertions that I find lack very much credibility or support? Can you talk about some of the things you've seen and heard in recent months?
Sure. So you're going to get me all wound up on this one. So on arms race, I completely agree with you. The way I mean, arms race to me is value neutral. Then my number one priority, I'm always looking at how are we going to protect Americans, safeguard our national security vital interests, follow through on our commitments to allies, based on the priority to deter major power conflict. So yes, we don't want anybody crossing the nuclear threshold. That is something that should be of the utmost priority. We don't want major nuclear power adversaries even setting foot down the path of conventional conflict that could get us close to the precipice of nuclear use. And so that to me is the highest goal. So if that's clear in your mind, then that necessarily means other things that you might like to avoid, like spending more money on hard power. Perhaps that's a political objective. You prefer not to do that, or you would prefer to pursue arms control. You know, all of those things, those are just tools in our buckets. You know, those are just other things that just should feed into furthering the credibility of deterrence, arms control or strategic stability, you know, all these other objectives. And so I think once you have that first thing first and these other things, you know, further down on the list of priorities, then I think you begin to make more sense. If you get them backwards, that's whenever you start to do things like run the risk of deterrence failure, because you're more worried about this notion that you don't want to increase the number of U.S. deployed nuclear weapons, or you don't want to increase our, you know, warhead production. You don't want to invest more in the nuclear enterprise, all these other things. It's like, well, what if you need to do them, to your point, in order to bolster the credibility of U.S. nuclear deterrence and assurance of our allies, in order to further the highest aim, which is to preserve peace and preserve America's vital interests and keep Americans and our allies safe. So that's my first big one. And I go back and forth on this, and I try to uncover some of these other motivating agendas whenever I get into a back and forth with people who might present the challenge to me that what I'm suggesting will precipitate an arms race, to which I say, tell me what you mean by arms race. And then what if the United States investing in these capabilities or increasing numbers or increasing or adapting the way we deploy actually furthers the highest aim, which is peace and credibility of deterrence. The other one is this. I think we are so backwards right now in terms of how people are talking about, and especially U.S. government officials talking about the phenomenon of escalation. So we heard this a lot when Russia first invaded Ukraine, which is this really strong fear of anything that the United States might do to bolster Ukrainian defense, that it could cause an escalation, it could cause the Russians to escalate either horizontally, geographically, into a NATO ally, or vertically, it could cause the Russians to employ a nuclear weapon, regardless of where it might be, and that we're trying to avoid those. And so this fear of escalation has had the effect of the United States really limiting what kinds of arms we provide, or the speed at which we provide them, and the constraints that we put on the Ukrainians for how they can employ American weapons. And that to me, the evidence has borne out that has not caused the Russians to go easier on the Ukrainians, but it has prevented the Ukrainians from succeeding in compelling the Russians back out of their territory or getting us closer to a conclusion of this war on terms that could in any way be defined as favorable to Ukraine and NATO. And then we're now seeing, we've seen this fear of escalation kind of reign in the media narrative and from U.S. officials and press secretaries, et cetera, from the U.S. government. When, you know, things like when the United States decided, President Biden decided not to go forward with that long-planned unarmed Minuteman III test while Russia was invading Ukraine, for fear that it could provoke or escalate a Russian response. I think that's just a poor understanding of the highest aim of American nuclear deterrence. You know, a responsible nuclear power like the United States defines responsible nuclear behavior by deterring aggression, not by just standing down and not testing our ICBMs. So that, to me, there's a lot of education, I think, that needs to happen on this point about escalation. And you know, as a we can look back, and Colin Gray talked about this too. You know, I wrote a piece, just a short little piece, trying to remind people of this too, that, you know, escalation is not the worst thing that can happen to us. The adversaries escalating to their definition of victory is the worst thing that can happen to us. And so you have to seize the momentum, and you have to escalate in order to compel your adversary to get, to steer him down towards de-escalating. So that, to me, is the other really misinformed understanding of how the United, and we're going to have to get better at that. I mean, the things that I think that the country needs to do as we move into what I've defined as, you know, we are in a new Cold War with these two major nuclear powers. We have to better understand and exercise those muscles, so to speak, on being willing to escalate in a way that steers our adversary down paths that are favorable to the United States.
Yeah, one of the things that I would have liked to have seen more of is a discussion, because for me, having, you know, I spent a year at Stratcom here recently, and, you know, having spent much of my career at the Air Force, I've seen that, you know, it's our precision capabilities, our PGMs, our fifth gen fighters, and particularly for the Russians, I mean, I would say they're the sort of shining example, is that they absolutely fear American air power flying across the Russian border, striking command and control targets, leadership targets, all with conventional munitions. And they don't really have a capability to stop it. You know, S-400s, S-500s, when they're all online, can't stop it. And therefore, you know, their view is, hey, we're going to go nuclear. It's sort of a reverse new look. And I hear lots and lots of folks talk about, you know, we need to get rid of nuclear weapons. We can strike the same targets with conventionals. And it's like, guys, you're sort of doing exactly what they fear, and you're making the problem worse, not better. And I would have liked to have seen more in the report discuss this sort of very challenge and why you can't, you know, conventional your way out of the problem. Can you talk some about that?
Well, we do touch on it a little bit by saying that if you do not, if the country, you know, President Obama really even famously, you know, wanted to move the, but I mean, this has really been across administrations, but he really elevated this notion that the United States wanted to rely less on nuclear weapons, that we wanted to move away from nuclear deterrence in our international defense strategy and rely more on conventional. But here's, so one of the recommendations was like, great, okay, we're going to have to really beef up conventional then if you don't want to rely more on nuclear weapons, because we're going to deter, we're going to successfully deter both of these major powers who are both committed to break up U.S. alliances and undermine U.S. security interests. That's the other thing that was important in the report, is we really did try to lay out the stakes. What are U.S. interests before we get to the threat? So that then you can say, well, what are they? You know, these are the threats, but you should first, before you understand what the threats are, you have to understand what U.S. vital interests are. And we try to do that as well as we could in the short number of pages that we had. But we do make that point. You know, you're going to have to bolt, you're going to have to beef up conventional if you don't want to rely on nuclear. And if you don't want to spend the money on conventional, you are going to have to rely more on nuclear. So there is, we touched on this sort of interplay between the two. But that's a good point, that, you know, there's more strategy. There's sort of more nuclear strategy conversation that needs to happen after post the commission's report. But another point that I've raised is, you know, when I hear people say, can't we just rely more on conventional? So it's not going to be cheaper. Not, depends on what you're trying to look at. If you want to put a weapon on this target, or you want to get over to here and you want to make sure that you can convince them that you can destroy these targets, how many conventional weapons are you going to need if you're going to swap out nuclear targeting for that particular thing? So to me, it's not a cheaper way to go. But the other thing is nuclear deterrence. There's something about nuclear weapons that has a psychological effect that contributes to deterrence beyond the physics package of what a nuclear weapon can do. And so I really caution people, be careful when you start doing deterrence on the cheap and you want to start swapping out how we do nuclear targeting and how we want to put a nuclear weapon on this target to be able to convince our adversary not to go down this path. If you start thinking you can swap out conventional, you're not going to do it. You're not going to save money, as far as I can tell, not readily, immediately. I have to do all the math. And there's smarter people who can do all of that. But two, you know, do you erode deterrence if it's not actually something, if you're actually chipping away at what our adversary truly fears about the United States and what we might do. So there's a lot, there's a lot of art to deterrence that sort of goes beyond just the mere math and the mere physics questions, I think.
Well, it's that time in the show where we have to take a quick break. We're talking to Rebecca Heinrichs, and we'll be right back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the Ann Law Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back, and you're listening to NucleCast. Of course, now I wanted to ask you this question, and this is the one that it perplexes me to no end. It's like, that irritant in an oyster that ultimately causes a pearl. And that's the idea of, I've been told 1,000 times that we can't afford, like, for example, the nuclear arsenal that is laid out in the Strategic Posture Commission report. And I'm actually pretty good with math, particularly money math. And as I look at the size of the U.S. economy, federal spending, defense spending, I look at, one of the variable or the things I like to point out most is that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services estimates that they lose $70 to $90 billion in those two programs every year to waste, fraud, and abuse. And yet no American knows that's the case. And if that's a number that we don't even know, but yet somehow we can't afford, 60 to 80 billion out of 800 billion in nuclear defense or nuclear arsenal and operations and maintenance. Can you explain to me the math that is being used by those who say it's unaffordable? Because I'm obviously not good enough to understand it.
Well, first you have to agree with some of their assumptions. So a lot of the folks that I've seen who jump in and make that argument that it's too expensive, these are folks who also don't buy into this idea that our nuclear weapons are deterring major power war, and in fact, especially the way we do targeting, since the 70s quite explicitly only do counter force targeting, so we're going to try to put weapons on our adversaries' military, target both conventional and non-conventional and their regime, elements of their regime, and then how they maintain control of their populations, et cetera. So you would have the people who I hear say, nuclear deterrence is too expensive, they'll say the way we do deterrence anyway is quote unquote destabilizing. So it's destabilizing, it's not safe, it's causing our adversaries to invest in their own capabilities, it's causing an arms race, it's too expensive. So it's kind of like this package. There's always this package deal whenever they make that. So you have to pull it apart. You have to say, okay, let's put all these other, let's just say that it does do what I think it's doing, which there's a correlation that it is, because we haven't seen a nuclear weapon employed since the United States did so to end World War II. Let's say that it does do that. And then we can get to the interesting numbers that you point out, which is that, looked at entitlements. Entitlements as a percentage of GDP is what is growing massively. If you look at the percentage of the U.S. budget, and the defense budget's actually going down as a percentage of U.S. GDP, and then the nuclear enterprise and nuclear deterrence is even a smaller percentage of what the United States. I don't remember the exact number. It kind of fluctuates, 6-7%, I think, or might be even less than that of the entire defense spending. So when you start to put that in perspective, and you're like, and this is what's contributing to peace and prosperity, it's the fundamental bedrock of what allows the United States to successfully project power abroad to maintain free and open sea lanes so we can have a global economy in the first place. You know, then you start to unpack that and you realize it's a great deal. And for the U.S. Strategic Posture Commission, you know, what we're recommending is that the United States makes changes now so that the United States has the option to make changes if we need to pretty radically, you know, in the next 3, 4, 5 years. But we've got, you know, workforce challenges. We're going to have to grow the workforce and supply chain challenges and all that kind of stuff. So we're not actually even arguing for massive, expensive, immediate changes in the near term, but just to set ourselves up to do this as a threat environment continues to deteriorate. But totally agree with your premise. As you know, relative to other ways this country spends money, it's a great deal for the U.S. taxpayer.
Now, it is that time in the show where I like to bring out Bob the Genie. And as I rub my magic lamp and Bob the Genie pops out, of course, he grants all guests 3 wishes. But they have to be on the topics that we're discussing. No world peace, no great wealth, no, you know, unlimited wishes. So 3 wishes related to our topics. So, Rebecca, as you come up with wish number one, what is that wish?
Number one, I want to maintain the bipartisan consensus that U.S. engagement and leadership in the world is a good thing. So there is this pull right now, both it's existed on the left end of the American political spectrum since forever, which is that the United States tends to make a mess of things. And so as the United States gets stronger and starts to try to, you know, maintain stability in regions in the Middle East and Europe and the Pacific, we're actually creating more problems. So that's the sort of the left end of the political spectrum, but it's popping up on the right. And so, and that is very concerning, because if you don't agree that it's a vital American interest to maintain free and open sea lanes in the Red Sea, in the Med, and beyond, you know, then a lot of what I'm arguing for, and that my fellow, you know, commissioners, Democrats and Republicans are arguing for, doesn't make sense. And so that would be my number one wish, is that we could maintain this bipartisan consensus for the U.S. role in the world.
Yeah, that's a good one. It is, you know, it is somewhat striking. There are some new think tanks that have come up in the last sort of 5 years that are, I would say, generally right-leaning, that are, you know, sort of non-interventionist. It's, in many respects, it's hearkening back to Robert Taft and those sort of non-interventionist Republicans of the 40s and 50s. So it's a interesting and good point. Okay. So that's wish number one. Wish number two.
Number two, I would say that we get super serious about U.S. missile defense, and in particular, U.S. missile defense of the homeland. One of the recommendations of the Posture Commission was that we build, adapt, invest in advanced technologies to close this vulnerability that our homeland has against the coercive threat from nuclear peers. So right now we've got a missile defense architecture that defends against the rogue state threat, North Korea primarily, and Iran if it gets an ICBM. But we're vulnerable to Russia and China. And, you know, Americans understand there's still broad bipartisan consensus that we want to help our allies abroad who are under attack, because they correctly understand that if we can keep those conflicts regional and far away, they can't escalate and harm Americans. But our adversaries might flip the script on them and say, oh yeah, well, what if we can attack the United States in such a way that paralyzes and causes us to be fearful, but doesn't enrage us, so that we back down and don't support our allies abroad. And then China can take Taiwan, Russia can take the Balts, et cetera. And so anyway, so I think advancing U.S. missile defense that becomes a serious national objective would be my second wish.
Okay, that's a good one. It's, you know, it's certainly a challenge to try to prevent, you know, those lower yield, you know, non-strategics that can be very coercive. So, okay, that's a good one. Okay, how about number three? What's your third wish?
Number third wish is that we get better at integrating what U.S. Strategic Command does with our regional combatant commands. So Indo-PACOM, you know, they might be really good at thinking about how they might take care of a China problem. But since China, I think there's so much we don't understand about how China might be thinking about nuclear weapons and how they might think about when they might use them and where on the escalation ladder. I know lots of people don't like the imagery of an escalation ladder, whatever you want to call it. You know, we're going to have to start, no kidding, getting smart about how we think about this conventional nuclear interplay, about how our adversaries are thinking about that. So I'd love to see some, no kidding, rather than just talking about how we need to be better at this, really getting more collaborative and integrated from our regional combatant commands and STRATCOM.
Yeah, that's another good one. It's certainly one that I can't help but agree with. So that's a good one. Now, if you wanted to leave our listeners, because we're at the end of the show, and so if you want to leave the listeners with sort of a takeaway from the Strategic Posture Commission report, what would that takeaway be?
We are in a threat environment far more dangerous than the Cold War, far more complex. And so, you know, this country is really in the middle of very tumultuous political disagreements, a lot of factions, but I think the one major takeaway is the extent that we can really kind of raise people's eyes up a little bit to understand we have a shared common threat against the United States and the peace that we've all enjoyed and the America that we've grown up in since the Second World War and safely through the Cold War. And so we are moving into an era we're going to have to make some serious changes, educate the American people, and try to maintain and garner consensus where we can.
All right. Rebecca Heinrichs, thanks for joining us on NucleCast.
Thanks so much.
And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you on the next episode. Great talk with Rebecca Heinrichs. You know, she's, of course, one of the commissioners from the Strategic Posture Commission. So as we've talked to her and Frank Miller and we've talked about the results of their report, you know, it's always interesting to see how each individual member has a different perspective and, you know, what they like to focus on. So it was really good to see what Rebecca thought and how she saw it. So hopefully you enjoyed the podcast.
This has been a production of the Amlod Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence. Our executive producer is Kimberly Jean Tim, and this episode has been